Welcome to Insight. It's PRN. My name is Mark Farrell. Thursday right here in New York City. We're waiting for Hurricane Joaquim to come our way. Or maybe it's not going to come our way. They keep changing their mind, depending on which channel you watch and what hour of the day it is. But hopefully you don't get doused as in Hurricane Sandy from a few years ago. We're going to be hearing from a great doctor today, Dr. Dudley Danoff, urologist, on his new book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. And thanks to the UN General Assembly, I am running very, very late today. My apologies. But I want to talk about a very serious topic going into Evan Murray. Evan Murray was a star quarterback that died last Friday and is being laid to rest, actually, as we speak. Really, really sad story. I'm sure you heard about it. Made national news, international news, actually. He collapsed after he was hit on a field during a game last Friday. And then he walked off the field, so it didn't look like apparently that he was that injured, certainly. He was a little dazed and woozy after being sacked in the backfield, but the autopsy was released yesterday that Evan died from a massive intra-abdominal hemorrhage due to a laceration of the spleen. So, I mean, that obviously is due to a hit, especially of high caliber. So according to the Morris County Medical Examiner's Office, that's what took place. So, you know, it was enlarged, apparently. It goes on, the medical examiner goes on to say his spleen was abnormally enlarged, thus making it more susceptible to injury. No evidence of head trauma or injury, heart disease, or anything of that. They ruled it accidental, certainly playing on the gridiron. So, interesting that Governor Christie and the Jets tweeted out some good things about their supporting Evan's family, the Murrays. But the town of Washington, New Jersey, Warren Hills Regional High School, where it's located, is just really, really crestfallen. You know, they lost a great kid. I mean, any kid, it's just a shame to see that happen. And the town is decorated in blue ribbons all over. I think they're going to be renaming the field after Evan Murray. And everyone just has incredibly kind, warm things to say about Evan. It's one of those just really sad, sad stories that happens. And all we can do is see if we can learn anything from it. So, you know, this has been in the news for quite some time now about football and the impact of it, especially in youth leagues. Now, I have a son who's 6 years old, and he can actually play football now, Pop Warner. And he said to me the other day, because he plays soccer, he's like, "Hey, Dad, where are the other kids that usually play with me?" And I'm like, "Well, they're playing football now." He's like, "Well, really? I want to play football." I said, "Okay, let me just tell you a little bit about football." And I kept it very neutral, explained to him, you know, the padding you wear and why you have to wear padding and sort of the overall spectrum of the sport. So he's kind of like, okay. And I said to him, you know, I've interviewed a lot of people on my radio show, some former Giants, George Martin, and some other guys. And they all say that if they have kids nowadays, they would not let their sons or daughters, got to be politically correct, play the game of football. And he's like, "Well, why, Dad?" I'm like, "Because it is so violent. It wreaks such havoc on one's body." And he's like, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "Well, you know, it's hard to kind of explain it, but really, remember I told you you always had to take care of your coconut?" That's what I tell him his head is, his coconut. "The head is so susceptible to injury and trauma that concussions are so rampant in football. I mean, the average guy has, you know, six or more concussions, depending on what position they play." So I was going on to tell him about the long-term effects, memory, and all these, you know, different. And I said, "It's a great game. And your dad sounds like a hypocrite right now." Of course, I had to explain what a hypocrite was. But the truth of the matter is, I like to watch it, but it really takes a toll on a human body. And he said right away, "I don't want to play football," and moved on. So we'll see if that's the case. But it made me think, certainly on the eve of, or actually what's taking place right now, Evan Murray's funeral, what took place almost a week ago, you know, where your head is at and where we stand as a nation. I know, obviously, with all the football scandals across the, in terms of all the different leagues, professional, college, and high school, and talking about Saraville last year, that it's being questioned. So now, with, you know, more news being revealed about the recent death, so it raises more questions. I mean, should rules be amended in terms of the physicality of the game? Makes you wonder about the gear. You know, is the gear designed? I would think it'd be designed. I mean, we can send people to the moon. We have pretty safe cars. so why can't we make really safe gear? But now, is that a false sense of security, though? If you have all this gear on, you feel like an Adonis, you feel like a juggernaut, and you're invincible, and you can go just like ream somebody because you feel that you won't get hurt. You know, they changed the rules of the NFL in terms of your head and tackling and things of that nature, and I'm sure it's taken some guys a little while to get used to it, and there's calls going, being called, I should say. But the reality is, you know, you're still going to get hurt. It's a dangerous game. Now, nationally, this statistic, I got to double check this statistic. Apparently, the same amount of injuries happen for football compared to other sports, soccer, basketball, etc. Now, I'd like to see a further breakdown of this stat. It says 180,000 high school kids across the nation in a calendar school year. But I would imagine that the football injuries are a little bit more severe, maybe more concussions, and maybe injuries that won't be really noticed until a few years down the road. I mean, how many of us, you as listeners, PRN listeners, know somebody or used to play sport yourself in high school, football in particular, and you have a bum knee, bad back, bad shoulder, something that was sustained just because, you know, chances are the average person in high school is not going to even play in college. If they do, maybe they're not going to even be a starter. So the reality is you have to be really good in your position, sizable or speed or both. So is it really worth risking, you know, being injured for the rest of your life? Just to play football so you can say, ah, yes, I'm part of the, you know, Colonials or Fighting Bulls or whatever your high school team was named. Just to have that sense of camaraderie, solidarity, to feel, you know, to get that confidence, which sports brings. But there's other ways to bring it. So, you know, I wanted to, we'll talk about this because we have the doctor who's going to be coming on shortly. But we wanted to really address this. So if your kid plays, and now, would you worry about the long-term effects? Are you just not really interested in acknowledging that they would get hurt? You know, and why would you let your kid play and at what age? 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Of course, you can always email me at mark@markfarrellmotivation.com, mark@markfarrell, F-A-R-R-E-L-L, motivation.com. You know, there's a lot to it, and we don't certainly want to, you know, undermine the game of football because I guess it's being done by everyone else, so I don't have to do it right here on Insight. But the reality is it's a tough game. It's a physical game. We all know that. I mean, look at rugby. Apparently, the stats are rugby players get hurt a lot less frequently than football players. It's still a violent game. But they're not, obviously, they know there's no helmets. So it's played in different fashion. So it'll be interesting. You know, I mean, obviously, baseball is America's favorite pastime. Football is the number one grossing sport. As a matter of fact, Real Sports has something on, I just caught on HBO, about Jerry Jones, owner of the Dallas Cowboys. It's really worth watching. But in terms of the amount of money that gets put into each franchise, but Dallas has been the number one franchise for, I think, a decade and a half now, worth over, I forget how many billion. Crazy. Between the ticket sales, marketing, merchandising, you name it. It's incredible. So that's a trickle down all the way to the high schools, even to the Pop Warner level. And then last thing I'm going to say before we move on and introduce our doctor who's on hold is that, you know, when you go to games nowadays, we've all heard about this, seeing parents on the sidelines. I think parents have a lot to do with this and can be obviously make a decision as a parent should whether their child should or should not play a sport at a certain age. But you see the parents on the sidelines of my son, and I'm a coach. I have to tell parents sometimes, you know, you have to step back and bring it down, use a lot of decorum when you do this. But they are just screaming at the top of their lungs, overpowering myself and the other coach about what to do, how to do it, et cetera. And it's not like, hey, go, Johnny. Yeah, great, Jenny. Good move, good move. It's more like, move your butt. You know, I mean, really, really, not really kind things to say. And the way they vocalize their opinions, it's just like, wow. it makes me think about how hard it would be to change the rules and or possibly eliminate, dare I say, eliminate the game of football in maybe under high school level. But then if you eliminate it under the high school level, when it gets to the high school level, you know, they're going to be totally inexperienced. But if everyone uniformly is inexperienced, maybe that wouldn't be a bad thing. Anyway, we'll get your calls in just a little bit. 888-874-4888. Okay, we're going to talk about a serious issue right now. Men, yes. When's the last time you had your prostate examined? I'm actually getting mine examined as we speak. I know, actually, in about 2 weeks. But I'd like to talk to you about a serious issue. Of course, we always have fun with serious and non-serious issues around here. My guest, Dr. Dudley Danoff, is a graduate of Princeton University and Yale University Medical School. He was taught on the clinical faculty of UCLA School of Medicine for over 25 years as founder and president of the prestigious Cedars-Sinai Tower Urology Medical Group in LA. Urologist to many Hollywood stars, which is an interesting interview right there, I imagine, and a recipient of national and international honors. Dr. Danoff is a senior attending urologist at the Sabin LA Free Clinic, and it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Danoff to the show. Hey, doctor, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Mark?
Ah, pretty good. Everything good out in L.A.?
Yeah, absolutely. How are things in Nuevo Yorkes?
Well, I guess if I could blow the wind, the rain that we're going to get out to the West Coast, you guys would be most appreciative.
Oh, please, absolutely. Oh, my God, we're dying out here.
It's bad. So let's break it down. Congratulations on your new book, by the way. It's getting a lot of acclaim. The number one simplest question, but a lot of people don't understand where and what the prostate does and how important it is.
Yes, well, the prostate is an organ. It's in front of the rectum and behind the testicles. That's anatomically where it is. And if you think of the urinary bladder as a balloon which is upside down, the prostate is like a donut or a collar around the neck of the balloon. And its purpose is to supply the seminal fluid. That is the fluid when one ejaculates, 99% of the fluid is prostatic fluid, and about 1% is actual sperm. So it's the lubricant that carries the fruit of life.
You know, it took you less than 30 seconds to say ejaculation. We had a bet going on here in the studios. So it's pretty clear cut that it's pretty important for guys to have.
Yeah, but the problem with it, Mark, is as it gets older, it becomes less efficient. And in becoming less efficient, it enlarges in its size.
Mm.
And then it begins to obstruct the flow of urine. So as men get older, it becomes problematic.
Ah, hence why older individuals go to the bathroom frequently and it's harder to actually urinate.
That's exactly right, because you can't empty your bladder. So when you urinate, you don't empty your bladder. And then when you drink a little cup of water or a cup of tea or coffee, your bladder is already half full, so you've got to go again.
So, of course, men over 40 should have an annual exam. Now, what I didn't understand, I need to have clarification from you. I think there's a digital device besides the doctor's finger that can be used?
Well, when we say digital rectal exam, the digit does, it's not a computer. It is a digit. It is a finger.
My bad.
A gloved finger. But we often use an ultrasound device, which
okay.
is like a fat finger. But the digit, it's not a computer. It's a
gotcha.
Digit.
Sorry. I mean, you know what? I imagine myself on all fours with a digital gun being pointed at you know what.
Oh my God, no!
Yeah.
It's an embarrassing exam,
it
but
is.
if it's done gently, it is not all that unpleasant. And my father was a dentist, and he said, if you want to be a good doctor, be gentle. So that's the aim.
How come your father? He was a dentist, and you went south in the body.
I got tired of watching him. You're looking
I guess
at
so. A different orifice, huh?
Absolutely. You know, we have to keep it in the family.
yeah, somehow. So now you say, of course, the key to prostate detection, keeping cancer at bay, is early detection. And obviously, if you're over 40 or 40 and above, it's annually. But can anyone, men listening, do anything on their own?
Well, unfortunately, nobody really knows what causes cancer. If you're an African American or if you have a male relative with a history of prostate cancer, you are far more likely to get it than someone else. but there are really no tricks. There is some anecdotal evidence, you know, high protein, lycopene, salt palmetto will prevent prostate cancer, but there's really not good solid evidence. So it's genetic, luck of the draw. I mean, there are certain things that you can do for sexual good health, keep yourself fit, low carbohydrate diet, exercise, low alcohol, stay away from nicotine, hard drugs. But there's really no way to prevent prostate cancer. We can cure it almost 100% if we can diagnose it at an early stage. So that's really the key.
And I guess the tricky part is that there are no symptoms.
There aren't any symptoms. Most symptoms that people relate to prostate are because of benign enlargement, so-called BPH, benign prostatic hyperplasia, which is the disease of older men. But those are not the symptoms of prostate cancer. And if and when you do have a symptom, blood and pain, it almost is always too late for cure.
Really? So,
really?
For example, I literally have an appointment in 2 weeks to go see my doctor for my annual.
Right.
So if I go there, and obviously...
PSA.
Yep.
Digital rectal exam, perhaps a prostatic ultrasound. And I think with those three things, you are really covered.
Okay, so now 3 months down the road, could something develop, and then we have another 9 months where it wouldn't be detected, possibly?
So prostate cancer is very slow growing
it
in
is.
Almost all cases.
Good.
So an annual physical, I think if you have a low PSA and a normal digital rectal exam, I think a year to year is just fine.
So now we have all men age 40 and over should get an early screening, as we were talking about.
Yes.
Should
screening saves lives. There's no question about it. There's been a dramatic decrease in deaths from prostate cancer since the age of PSA, this magical blood test. It's not perfect. PSA, prostate-specific antigen, simple blood test. It's not the perfect test, but it's the best that we have.
Now, you are, in your bio, it said you are the urologist of stars. So I guess we're all kind of the same in that department, right?
Yeah, well, that's what I say to all the people. I say they put their pants on, you know, one leg at a time and, you know, wipe their tush with one square of toilet paper just like the rest of us. So some of them are very, very nice, and most of them are very nice, and some of them, you know, are jerks, just like
everyone
anywhere.
Else. Absolutely.
But we treat them as real, you know, as real people. If he's a king or a star, I say, look, if I make exceptions for you in the way I examine you or treat you, I'm going to make a mistake. And most, I would say, the overwhelming majority of them just understand that and comply very nicely.
Absolutely. Now, one thing about having money, though, is good that you could have, you know, you can have many exams a year versus your insurance company only pays for one annual if you're male or female. So that would be a nice perk, though, because, well, not that anyone wants to get a detection twice a year, but...
Unless they're in love with their doctor.
Hey! Actually, that's a very good question. How many in your field, is there a percentage of female urologists?
Yes, there are. There are more and more female urologists. I actually have one of my older partners who's been with me for more than 20 years as a female. So about 20 years ago, when we brought her into our group, which is 12 urologists, it was kind of unique. But now there are many, many women in urology. We're about to hire our second woman. So,
how old is she?
Men feel comfortable with a woman. Many men actually relate better to women. They feel it's more gentle touch. It's a more feminine way. It's not so direct.
It's natural.
Very natural.
yeah
right.
That's pretty cool. I like that. I think I may reevaluate my GP doctor here.
Yes, we have to make sure she trims her nails, you know, on a regular basis. Very important to do that.
Yes. So I guess when you go through the interview process, you immediately look down at their nail.
Yeah, that's
So
that's
we're going to kind of switch gears, but in the same kind of department, because it makes me think about it like a broader range for men's health. What about STDs in 2015? Where do we stand?
Well, STDs are all over the place, and we still are faced with, you know, HIV/AIDS.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
so I'm very, very liberal. You know, if your door is closed, what happens between two consenting adults in the privacy of their own home is their concern. I only say practice safe sex. So we just about can cure everything, but, you know, HIV/AIDS still remains problematic.
Of course. But what about herpes and gonorrhea and things of that nature?
Well,
I mean, are they – obviously, they still need treatment, and is it herpes that does not dissipate?
Very, very, very prevalent. You know, unfortunately, there's no cure for herpes.
Mm-hmm.
So herpes is a self-limited disease. It's very, very common. There are drugs for it, but we really can't cure it. I mean, gonorrhea is still susceptible to antibiotic treatment. There are some resistant strains of gonorrhea that are very, very difficult to treat. But again, it all goes back to safe sex.
And going back to detection, if you do detect that there's obviously in a large prostate, what are the procedures and what are the steps?
Well, certainly with prostate cancer, if the patient is a candidate for prostate removal, we do this operation with a robot, which we've been doing for nearly 10 years.
And you must have a name for this robot.
Well, it's called a Da Vinci.
Da Vinci? You got to rename it. We'll come up with a better name for you.
And it's a spectacularly safe operation. It preserves potency. It preserves continence. It doesn't require an incision. It's done mostly as an outpatient with an overnight stay in a surgery center. It's just a remarkable forward pass from what we used to do. So early detection, we can cure it. And the robot is just like a miracle.
Now, when you say early detection, doctor, is that depending on the actual size and the test you were talking about, the PSA test?
Yes. I mean, what we want to do is we want to discover the prostate cancer while it's still within the bounds of the prostate.
Uh-huh.
And has not escaped from the prostate. If it's within the bounds of the prostate, we consider it curable. If it's outside the bounds of the prostate, it's still treatable, eminently treatable, but not curable. We want our patients to die with prostate cancer, not of it.
Okay, now, if any of our listeners are squeamish, I advise you to go in the other room, get a cup of coffee, give us a few seconds alone here with my doctor. So, doctor, what do you look for when the actual exam is underway?
Well, what we look for is, if you think of the prostate sort of like a plum, what we're looking for, we want it to be symmetrical on examination. We want it to be soft. We don't want it to be lumpy or bumpy. So asymmetry, nodularity, bumpiness, irregularity, tenderness, those are the things we're looking for and which we consider to be abnormal.
And how large is a normal prostate?
Probably about the size of a small plum.
Okay. Well, I wasn't sure if the plum analogy was just picture size or a physical size. Okay,
no,
got it.
No, it actually is physical size.
Both,
right?
Both. So now, how long does this exam be? Because, you know, my doctor, like, he gets tired. He sits down after, like, 5 or 7 minutes.
It shouldn't take more than 30 seconds.
30 seconds. Okay, I'm going to bring a stopwatch with me next week.
There you go.
That's for sure. Now, treatment-wise and medication-wise, does this interfere? You said early detection, of course, but with other medications, if it's not caught early enough where medication's needed, incontinence could happen, and other obviously side effects.
Well, we have some really good medications for decreasing the size of a prostate. So many men, as they say, as they age, get this BPH or this benign enlargement of the prostate. And we have many, many good drugs that both reverse that trend and allow a man to urinate more freely. Some of those have negative side effects on sexuality, but they're very minor. And they usually occur in older men where it becomes less important. In terms of prostate surgery for prostate cancer and the use of the robot, we preserve continence so that patient is not, you know, pishing on their shoes, as we say in Brooklyn.
Yeah, I like it.
And they're still able to get an erection. So those are real changes and real progress. And the fear of a lot of younger people to get checked because they say, oh, my God, if I do have prostate cancer, it's over. That's just not true.
I've actually known a few guys in my inner circle that have had it and have gotten very high, you know, great results and, you know, normal life.
You know, Mark, a lot depends on the skill of the surgeon,
sure.
You know, the robot engineer, the man sitting at the console.
Whether I had too much coffee that morning or not.
Well, the nice thing, believe it or not, the nice thing about the robot, I mean, you know, I've been a surgeon for 35 years, and sometimes I have what's called an intention tremor, where sometimes I've had a little too much coffee. But if I'm sitting at the console of the robot, any little tremor or intention tremor disappears because you're at the joystick, and the robot arm that's doing the surgery is at the other end. And any little movement on the surgeon's hand is not reflected in the robot arm. I mean, it's...
That's reassuring.
Yeah, very
reassuring. Dr. Dudley Danoff is my guest. He's a urologist and author of his new book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. So you're at a party, doctor, having one of those little hot dogs, even in L.A. Are those little hot dogs in a bun pretty popular? Everyone has them, right?
Pigs in a blanket.
Yeah, pigs in a blanket. You got to have them, right? You're universal.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I bet you women probably ask you more interesting questions at parties. So listen, my husband or my boyfriend, I was worried. I bet you get field. You have to field a lot of questions from women.
I do, and you have to have a sense of humor about it, and you have to be delicate in your approach. And women are just as curious, maybe even more curious. I mean, they're the ones that are pushing their husbands. You know, a woman would never miss her pap smear or her annual breast examination, and she's got to stand behind her man and push him to get his annual physical exam. All of us are macho. You know, we were talking about the tragedy, you know, in the NFL. We all want to be the hero at the end of the Super Bowl, you know, throwing the pass in the last 3 seconds to win the game. And men, you know, men are just macho. They don't want to take care of themselves. And it's the women in our lives that are pushing us. You know, hey, baby, you got to take care of yourself. We need you. My six-year-old son needs you.
And we need them.
Yeah, we need them.
Okay, this could be a very, very naive question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is there any way you could injure your prostate?
It's very hard. I mean, it's something called a straddle injury.
I have some crazy pictures in my brain right now.
Yeah, that's it. bikers are a little prone to get prostatitis because
that's where I was going.
Of the bike seat and some nerve damage. Most of that is temporary, and there are ways of getting around it. There's the split bicycle seat, a padded bicycle seat, but it's pretty hard to injure the prostate.
Now, I'm a cyclist, and I was wondering about that, a road cyclist, especially because the seats are small. But they did come out with that seat about, 10 years ago, the split, which allows more flexibility
within
that area.
I mean, certainly as a road biker, I would certainly be much more concerned about head injuries than prostate injuries, as you well know, Mark.
Yeah, and people texting in their cars because...
I see these guys, you know, on the PCH, the Pacific Coast Highway, you know, people speeding by, and they're on this little narrow bike lane, and they hit a rock or a rut in the road. And it's be careful out there.
Oh, it's dangerous! It's dangerous. So, in terms of treatment, one more final question. In terms of treatment, it's late when the detection happens. Talk about that scenario.
So, if a patient is not a candidate for the robot removal of the prostate, there are other very, very effective modalities of treatment, including radiation, which can be delivered externally, or implantation of seeds. There's certain hormonal manipulation that we can do. Prostate cancer is exquisitely sensitive to testosterone. So if we take testosterone away from the system, the prostate cancer will literally shrivel up. So there are effective treatments and drugs out there. So even people with, quote, advanced prostate cancer, you can be kept alive and stable, this has been great progress in the last few years.
How do you reduce the level of testosterone by the injection of estrogen?
No, it's actually a drug that actually blocks the synthesis of testosterone from the testes. I mean, the other way, obviously, is you can castrate somebody. So we can either do that mechanically or surgically, which we do rarely today, or we can use a drug that chemically castrates a person. So that's not desirable, but extremely
temporary.
It can be temporary,
okay,
but it's extremely effective treatment for advanced prostate cancer.
You know, if that drug went on the market, it would clean up. Can you imagine some wives who are very, very bitter for a cheating husband or something? You give this while they're sleeping, a temporary castration, you know, the last 30 days. Oh, my Lord.
Put it in his orange juice in the morning.
Yeah, they would never know.
I'll get that SOB.
Oh, yeah. And then Dr. Phil will have him on their show. Oh, my God. Yeah. We got a whole gamut of opportunity here.
Right.
Yeah. You got to think really out of the box here.
And now, Mark, very, very imaginative.
You got to be in radio, you know? You got to create the theater. So now, why write a book about this? I mean, you've been doing this for so many years. You are obviously a trailblazer on many avenues and starting the medical group and many more things, and obviously a well-to-do student at Yale and Princeton. Why this and why now?
Well, I actually started this project about 15 years ago when a patient came in and said, you know, you speak all around the world and you're a funny guy and you're very insightful. Why don't you write a book? And he gave me a 3x5 card, and on the 3x5 card it said, Penis Power. I said, wow, what a great title for a book. So I started on the weekends writing an original. The original book was Penis Power, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. And a lot of people thought penis is a pejorative word, which, of course, it is, and it's a body part, just like an elbow or stomach. And it got a lot of attention, and I try to answer a lot of questions, just the kind of questions you're asking me this morning, Mark. You know, a lot of ignorance or fear out there. Why do things work? How do things work? A lot of misconceptions. So I try to keep it informative, medically accurate. Hey, I have to do it with a sense of humor, obviously.
Sure, in a wink. Yeah, absolutely.
And so that's what I did, and I've been doing this for a long time, and it's been very successful, and it gets me away from surgery, and it's stimulating, and I meet a lot of people and travel all around the world, so it's been a great ride.
Are there any other aspects of men's health that need to be debunked that men, especially, are misunderstood about or don't understand?
Men have a lot of, you know, self-doubt about size, about performance, and it's all about the power of positive thinking. You know, the Lord gave you the equipment that you have. You can't do anything about it. There's no way to enlarge it, unfortunately. I mean, if there were, I'd be doing it and retired on an island in the South Seas.
Yeah, on your own
island.
You
gotta look down and say, it's mine. It's, you know, it's, I love you, you love me. Let's go and have some fun.
Yeah. You know, I never got hung up on that, and I don't think I'm gifted. I'm Irish.
Well, because you're realistic, you know.
Yeah, I just don't imagine. I don't, and all of my friends, I guess maybe it's something they wouldn't share. It'd be like, you know, I'm really sad. You know, what's the matter, Johnny or Bob? Well, you know, I got a small penis.
No, you know.
Okay, good slap on the back and kick him out the door.
So here's a good insight for you, Mark. I've seen more penises than can fill a rose bowl, and I've seen a lot of the women attached to those. And never once in all my years of practice has a woman come to say, Dr. Danoff, can you make my man's penis longer, fatter, wider, thicker? Not one. But they have said, can you make it a little firmer and attach it to a sweeter, nicer guy?
There you go. Well said.
Preferably with a Platinum American Express card.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Have to pay for your services too, right?
That is the deal, Mark.
Well, there are accoutrements for that if they're really interested in something of that nature.
Well, I mean, in terms of size?
Well, yeah, all kinds of things, yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, there's all kinds of things out there that are crazy and ridiculous. And, you know,
whatever you're into.
Yeah, and as I said, as long as it's safe and it doesn't hurt anybody, I'm as a health professional, I'm okay with it.
Now, one more avenue we're going to go down, literally, kind of, sort of, metaphorically, gay men. Do you think gay men have enough education overall versus straight men?
Well, look, I think, you know, when HIV/AIDS came in and it devastated the gay community, nobody knew what the hell was going on. I think gay men, and I certainly have a huge number of gay men in my practice, they're very, very intelligent. They're very knowledgeable about safe practices. HIV/AIDS is definitely under control, certainly here in West Hollywood, where my office is located. So, yes, I think they're very, very aware of safe sex practices, and they're very, very sophisticated, probably more so than heterosexual male.
Interesting. I guess so, because obviously there are a lot more precautions that have to be taken.
Yes.
So where do you see this science down the road, Doctor? Do you find that that the female bodies, I think, are changing more rapidly for younger women? Things happen sooner, the development. Do you find or see or suspect the body, human body, more specifically the male, will undergo any changes, and bear with me here, I know it's kind of a reach, just because of the GMOs we ingest, our diets, environment, all these different circumstances?
Well, you know, I don't think I'm qualified to talk about that, but what else I will tell you is, you know, our male population is living longer and staying healthier. When I started in practice, Mark, it was very rare for me to see a 100-year-old man a month. Now I see two or three a week. And although they can't jump as high or run as fast, I mean, they are having sex into their 80s, some even into their 90s. We have that class of drugs, you know, Viagra, Cialis.
Mm.
If your erection lasts longer than 4 hours, you know, call everybody you know.
Or put it in a car door.
absolutely. So, you know, men are living longer, healthier. They're sexually active, you know, into the seventh, eighth, ninth decade. So that's been a big, big change for me. Exercise, diet, I don't know whether GMOs are good or bad, but the effect, as I see it, as a health professional, as a urologist, I see a lot more older and healthier men, I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely. Now, we understand certainly as the body ages, everything slows down. And for men specifically, the refractory period, that's the time in between erections. You're impressed with that word?
Yes, I am.
Yeah.
You must have read my book, Mark.
Yeah,
my
of course I do. Refractory period, of course, I remember being, you know, 19, 20, 25. It's like,
when it was 2 seconds.
No time out. There was no time out. There's no time to even go to the bathroom or just wipe your forehead or the sweat off your brow.
Yeah. Erection 24/7.
Yeah, now you can kind of read War and Peace in between now.
Right. The old expression is, it takes me all night to what I used to do all night long.
Exactly. There you go. So the only thing that really changes, obviously, are maybe the intensity of the ejaculation,
right,
the duration, and possibly
the volume of the fluid that comes out.
Glad you said
that. There's no question that it's different. Is it less satisfying? I don't know. Does an older man have longer staying power? He does. Is that a benefit? It probably is. And there's the old lady that comes in with the sign. You know, she says, "Please, no Viagra."
So, are you a proponent of those drugs?
Oh yeah, I think they're great drugs. Even if I wasn't, it's a billion-dollar drug. With Cialis in particular, older men are using it not only for erectile function, but it's been approved by the FDA for enlargement of the prostate. So I have many patients that take it. It has a dual purpose. There are very, very
few downsides. So it shrinks something and expands another?
Say that again?
It shrinks and expands.
In a way, it does. Well, it just increases blood flow is what it really does.
Gotcha. So it heals. It helps the healing process?
It should not be abused, though, by younger people. I mean, there are younger guys that are using it in an abusive way who don't need it, you know, just want to be the, you know, weekend warrior. And there are cautions against that.
Mm.
But now, in general, it's a very safe class of drugs.
Doctor, I never thought the interview would be going this way, but I've got to ask you this question because it boggles my mind how, you know, certain medicines can go to certain parts of the body and activate whatever it is that needs to be activated.
Right.
How does medication know to go to that part of the body and do its job?
Well, I don't know how. Look,
it's a tough one, right?
these drugs, which are called PDE5 inhibitors, basically they're vasodilators, mean they open the blood vessels and increase blood flow. And what happened, Viagra was the grandfather. Viagra was introduced as a substitute for nitroglycerin for men who had coronary artery disease and had what's called angina.
Mm-hmm.
So they started the study because there was no money in nitroglycerin, so they wanted a fancy new nitroglycerin drug. And the study went along, and they found it wasn't really very good for opening the coronary artery, so they discontinued the study, and they asked everybody to give the drug back. It was a controlled study, and the men didn't want to give the drug back.
Yeah, because they were walking around with these hospital gowns on with poles sticking out.
And so it was absolutely a serendipitous. So you ask me, how did they find it? In this case, completely by accident.
They stumbled upon it.
Stumbled upon it.
Really? I never knew the backdoor insight to that.
Interesting story.
The ultimate guide to male sexual health. How are you going to follow up this new blockbuster?
Well, I don't know. This is it's a new baby. I'm just going to nurture it along. You can go to my website, The Ultimate Guide to Male Health, and there's a lot of stuff there. I blog, I tweet, so I'm out there.
You blog and tweet?
Yeah, Dr. Danoff.
you're a pretty hip doctor, my friend.
Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you very much for sharing your insight and vast expertise on this very delicate issue. And finally, actually, one more question.
Yeah,
is this most likely genetics play a role, hereditary?
Yes. A lot of genetics in prostate cancer. We haven't unraveled, you know, the key, but the cure, a lot of the new medications for treatment, for diagnosis are genetically based. So there's going to be a lot coming down that road, yes.
All right, Dr. Danoff, thank you very much for your time. And if I have any issues, I'm going to send you my results next week. And when the doctor does that, what was the index, the gun, what was I thinking?
DRE, digital rectal exam.
Yeah.
There you go.
I'm going to say to him, where's your gun? And I'll maybe hopefully get a joke out of him thinking that it's a different digital type of thing. That's the world we live in. See, I'm thinking digital, not digits.
Yeah, I know everybody does.
They do. I'm not the only one.
I'm getting into my portion coming over for your computer. I said, no computer here. Just an index finger.
That's all you need, some gloves and some lubricant. Doctor, all the best to you. Thank you for your time.
Mark, thank you for having
me. Okay, enjoy. Get some rain over there.
Yeah, I hope so.
Hey, we got some emails before. We're talking about Evan Murray, the unfortunate demise quarterback that died last Friday, who's being laid to rest right now. We're not really going to be able to get to the calls. I'm sorry about that. But basically, he collapsed after he was hit on the field during a game last week. And the autopsy released that he died from a massive intra-abdominal hemorrhage. That was due to a laceration of the spleen. That was according to the ME of Morris County. It's a real shame. And the bigger question we were kind of dabbling on was the violent nature, the physical nature, the physicality of football. You know, you're a parent. How old is your son or daughter? Would you let them play? Are they playing right now? Are you second-guessing your decision to let your child play? If they've had a concussion, how many concussions have they endured? I've had one massive concussion, and it was a miracle that I actually survived. I was riding a bicycle entirely too close to a box truck in New York City, and this is probably about 1990, 91, probably going about 28, 30 miles an hour because I was drafting off him, meaning he was blocking the wind. And all of a sudden, he locked his brakes up, and there was no way I was stopping, and I did not have a helmet on, and my head slammed into the back of that black diamond bumper that we all see. And I didn't lose consciousness, but basically for about a week's time, I was sleeping incessantly. I'd say maybe 18 hours out of the day. I had to be woken up. You know how that works. But basically, it rocked my world. Really, really rocked my world. And after that time, I was extremely cognizant of being safe. And I wore helmets every time since then. But it leads me to think about certainly the overall impact of football. And when I was a teenager, I was not allowed to play football. And I was a little bit pissed off at the time because my doctor, I have a very rare visual impairment, I cannot get blows to the head because my retina will detach. I'm much more predisposed to having a detachable retina because of my condition that I have. My brother actually played, he was 15 years older than me. His retina detached and he had to go through a procedure and everything. Can it be fixed? Can it be reattached? Yes, but why would you take that chance? So my quandary back then was, you know, being a kid a relative size in high school, not till my junior, senior year did I shoot up, was, you know, being questioned from the coaches and my buddies, hey, why aren't you playing? You know, are you a blank? And I'd be like, no, I can't play because the doctor said and blah, blah, blah. And it would kind of, you know, most people believe it, but I'm sure a lot of people, you know, who sometimes think that I don't have a vision problem because for all intents and purposes, I don't walk around and bump into the walls here in the PRN studios. Once in a while, they move the mic cables around, I trip, but that's okay. It's all in good jest, right? but the reality is, you know, it's a dangerous sport. What do we want to do about it? Do we need schools to make this decision, legislation to be drafted? Can it be done individually? Or Actually, this could be a telltale sign, or maybe not, but there is a Pop Warner League by where I live. And we're getting, as I mentioned earlier, I coach soccer for six-year-olds, and we got a lot of late signups. And the reason why is because the Pop Warner League did not have enough players to have a league this season. There weren't enough players for teams. So I was wondering if that was indicative of, you know, a change in the sea of interest, whether it's because, I don't know, maybe a lack of population for that age group, possibly, whether it's parents being more sensitive to the issue, or, you know, they just don't want their kids who are, whatever, 6, 7 years old running around the field, you know, getting banged up and dinged up. Because the reality is they're just going out there and having fun. And maybe we keep it a Pop Warner, and maybe we, you know, revisit the high school stage. Who knows? There's a lot out there, a lot of material. I just want to present it to you because that's what we do here at PRN. We stir the mind. We get you to think, especially on Thursdays. The show is Insight. Of course, you can check out this show or any past shows on the podcast page at PRN.fm. Gary Noel has a great show for you, as he does each and every day right here from 12 to 1 o'clock. Love our new studios. I just passed Gary in the studio. I gave him another thumbs up because they are gorgeous here. Of course, look forward to speaking to you anytime. Next week, especially, if you'd like me to speak at your school or corporation, check me out at markfarrellmotivation.com. That's markfarrellmotivation.com. Have a great day. Hope Hurricane Jacqueline misses us big time wherever you are. Hope it's sunny and safe, and enjoy your day, Mark Farrell. Take care. Enjoy.